Okay, we had gotten a little bit sort of off the track, but as I was saying, sometimes that's the best kind of interviews. But what I would like to do before we finish up is come back just a little bit and talk a little bit more about your university career, what you did on the campus, some of the changes that you saw in the campus and in the student body and that sort of thing over your tenure here. You said earlier that the classes were fairly small. Presumably, interest in engineering has grown over the years. Have you seen this reflected in the class sizes?
Oh, yes, definitely. But one thing, too, that after shortly after World War II, we had an older student group here.
GIs and things like that.
When I came back, we didn't have, in civil engineering that I recall, we didn't have a half dozen people who had not served in the military. Something, maybe Army, Navy, Marines, or somewhere. In fact, we had a young fellow who was fairly successful, John Tilden, who was kind of a baby in our class, because he had come directly out of high school. And here we were, I was, I was about 30 years old when I came back.
Mm-hmm.
And your John was about 19 or 20, and we probably gave him a rough time. He thought we gave
him
a rough time, but he was kind of, we kind of took him under our wing because we'd seen a lot more than he had. And
do you think that gave students at that time an advantage over students nowadays coming straight out of high school?
I think it did, because I think we'd gotten kicked around a little bit, and we're older, more mature, and we knew what we wanted when we came back. Now, we see a lot of students now that are still unsure. You can see that they're not interested in some things. They don't see the value. When most of us came back at a later age, I think we realized that every course that we took had some value. And students now don't see it that way. They say, well, that course I'll never use. I don't know why I need to study it. Whereas when we came back, and I was that way the same way when I went to school the first time. I'm sure we all are. We don't.
Sure.
We're not mature enough or experienced enough to appreciate what we're getting out of classes. And
you know, a friend of mine and I were talking about the same sort of subject the other day. A lot of times you take things, you think at the time, how am I ever going to use this? But you integrate it so much with other knowledge that you gain, that you never even know where you apply it later in life.
That's what I try to tell them. You may think that you'll never use this, but every course you have, it doesn't make a difference what it is a course in problem solving of some kind. And each course is a different way to solve a problem. Now, you might not think psychology or political science is a problem-type course, but there are problems and solutions that you must address in all of those courses, and they can be applied universally. And the process is the same. So problem solution is the same in any area, the approach to the solution. And you get a different approach to the solution, though, in each of the different classes. And this is the hardest thing, to, I think, to get across to students.
How is technology? I know that spoke about the computer,
grown. So the available knowledge, the requirements, we've and one of the things that bothers me is maybe if Dr. Sorensen would see this and hear me say it, he'd probably disagree with me, but he's trying to reduce hours in civil engineering. Now, when I was in school, we had 152 hours required to get the degree. And now the requirement is 144. Now, there's a heck of a lot more to learn now than there was 40 years ago.
Yet they're wanting to cut the hours.
Still,
back.
They want to cut back, and they want to put, and I don't object to putting more social sciences and humanities in. That isn't it. What they're trying to do is to maintain the same number of hours, or cut hours, and still increase the number of social science and humanities hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I recognize that we all have to be well-rounded people.
But something's got to go somewhere if you
But
start.
If you're going to do that, then you need to say, well, we got to go to a five-year curriculum.
Well, isn't engineering now pretty much considered a five-year program? I know that most of the people that
Well,
I know
most of them take 5 years, it's actually about a 4.5. If you took a 15-hour, 4.5 years would be 10 semesters, wouldn't it? 14.5 would be 145 hours.
Yeah.
So if you figure an average of 14.5, 15 hours, then it's a 4.5 year program. Most of us, when we were in school before, though, took more hours than that. I did my best work when I took 20 and 21 hours. I didn't have time to do anything else but study. But if I took 14 or 15, I wouldn't start studying until 9 o'clock or 9:30 at night. Then I didn't have time to finish everything.
I agree with you. I found that myself getting into the same pattern. If I'm not busy, you don't have time to do things.
That's right.
But if you've got a lot to do,
You get it done, that's right. And I think that's a big difference now, because the average number of hours that the students take is only about 13.5 per term.
Mm-hmm.
So they're making it a 5-year program. But it could be a good 4.5 year program. It could be a 4-year. If you took 18 hours, 8 times 18 hours is 144 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be doing the same thing in 4 years. And certainly you can do it in 4 years if you take the summer school.
So you think that with the technology that we have now, that really the way to go would be to increase rather than decrease? But you see no trend towards that?
Well, there have been a number of conferences held, national conferences that have tried to address the technical education. And that is the recommendation of most of the, that come out of most of these conferences, that we go to a full 5-year program, recognize it's a 5-year program, and go that way. And most of the people now are looking for courses in addition to the types of courses. They think we ought to have a course in accounting, personnel management, safety, courses like this. Conflict resolution. There's litigation everybody's involved with now. They feel like we ought to have some coursework in these areas. And I feel like in order to do this, you've got to go to a 5-year program. There's one thing that the university that I don't like, I guess it's the entire state system, and I think it contributes to the smaller numbers of hours per term, and that is the charge by the hour. If you had a fixed fee for, say, 14 or 15 hours, and everybody paid that fee regardless of the number of hours they took, then people would take more courses. Students are handicapped now because they don't have the money to pay for 18 hours, I think, in many instances.
Yeah, I agree.
And that is that's one of our real problems.
And courses keep getting more expensive and not less so.
That's right. Exactly. But I think that the university, I think, would make more money. Would get more intuition if they did that. Because you see students taking 9 and 10 hours a term. Now, they're occupying space just like anybody else.
Yeah, sure they are.
So it's inefficient for the university, the state, and the student.
When you went through, it was, I presume it was the same way.
We had a fixed fee.
It was a fixed fee. Mm-hmm.
I don't know when they went to the cost per hour. I'm pretty sure it was fixed fee. I wouldn't swear to it because I was on the GI Bill and they paid it, but
a lot of people went through on that GI Bill. That was a popular way of sort of paying.
I'm pretty sure it was a fixed fee at that time. And I think we ought to go back to it.
What other changes have you seen that you...
Paperwork.
More
paperwork, which is true in all business, I guess. We're not the only ones, but...
You feel like you do more administrating, or when you were teaching, did more administrating than you did teaching?
More now than we used to, yeah. Well, I've been involved with advisement. Now, faculty who do most of the research and teaching are not that much affected, but when I was doing I used to do the advisement for all the students that came in civil engineering until about 7 or 8 years ago. And we started to get so large I couldn't handle them all, and then we started I had to handle them the first time they came in, and then
divvy them up
the last 2 years, the last year and a half.
How did you get started into advisement from, was that something that you did?
It's just something that, I suppose it was the location of my office more than anything else, because my office used to be just next to the secretary's office, and just around the corner from the department chairman's office. And the department chairman wasn't there, a student would come in for advisement, and the secretary would send him in and talk to me. Just kind of developed, and I was interested.
You just happened to be handy. And
yeah.
Did you enjoyed advising?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it very much. And in fact, over the years, I have had children of former students who would have their parents would ask to come in and see me, regardless of whether they're going to engineering or not. I've talked to quite a few people in business, in architecture, in agriculture, because their parents graduated in civil, and they said, "Well, if you want advice, go see Professor Spangler." The dean's office will quite often send people down to talk to me if they don't know what area they want to study. Mm-hmm.
I worked over, when I was putting myself through school, I worked over in academic advisement through the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, but as you know, we saw, at that level, we saw whether they were going into engineering or into nursing. We saw everyone that came in initially, and I enjoyed that part. The advising is very gratifying to be able to help someone.
The University College advisors, if a student had expressed an interest in engineering, there were two people that they would send them to talk to. One was Watson Freeman, old mechanic, and the other one was me. And so we knew those people over there, and they knew us. So if somebody wanted to know something about engineering, they'd send them to one of us. It's a great experience.
Have you completely retired now?
No, I'm still 15%.
And what do you do in those?
Whatever the department chairman asks me to, generally. I still do some advisement. The young lady that helped me with advisement is just two doors down here, and when she has problems, she'll send Steve down and talk to me. I attend conferences and meetings with the department chairman.
This engineering, you mentioned earlier that you did engineering sort of as a hobby and you did something else to make your living, but do you still feel engineering is a sort of a hobby with you?
Well, it's always been fun.
You've always
put it that way, yeah. It's been, of course, the main source of income, but it's fun.
Do you still get to teach at all?
No, except occasional one-day or two-day lectures.
Mm-hmm.
I still give the civil engineering part of the introduction to engineering, and I'm on the...
That's that one-hour course, isn't it? I know a lot of people take that course if they just need an hour.
And I'm on the Board of Professional Engineers for the state, and then I'm asked to speak at... asked to talk to the class in professionalism and ethics, and also in contracts and specifications. So,
what sort of class is that, professionalism and ethics?
Well,
it's an interesting title, anyway.
It's a course that is considerable reading on cases and which are considered to be classics in violation of ethics. Court cases, like the Hyatt Regency failure, for example, the BART system in California. It's an effort. Many people think you can't teach ethics after the age of 10. If you haven't developed an ethical sense for that, you might as well forget it. However, I think that you can... make people aware of their ethical responsibilities, even though they may not be ethical, and the consequences of not acting ethically. And that's what I think the professor in that course attempts to do. It's not a matter of trying to teach ethics, but make you aware of what of the development of the ethical principles and the consequences of the violation of ethical principles.
And you say you give the introductory lecture?
No, that's in the introduction to engineering. I talked to that class about chapter 471, which is the state statute that regulates engineering.
Uh-huh.
And there is a section there that has to do with ethics in engineering practice, and what negligence is, what ethical violations are, things of this nature that they can expect to be faced with once they get out into practice. There's a certain code that we're expected to adhere to in terms of our responsibility to the public. And this is, I try to give them that side of it that has to do with the engineer and the law.
So they do get some exposure then to, you mentioned earlier, some of the things they wanted to add.
Sure.
County,
we get a little smattering of it.
In addition to hands-on engineering, they also get some other things. Do you, in addition to your, obviously now your 15% doesn't take up that much of your time, what other things do you do now that you...
Well, as I say, I'm a member of the Board of Professional Engineers, and that takes quite a bit of time. with our meetings, committee meetings. And as a part of that, I'm also a member of the National Council of Examiners for Engineers and Surveyors. This is an organization that prepares and administers the examinations for all engineering in the all the United States and its possessions. And I'm the incoming chairman of that committee. 1991-1992 year. We are responsible for preparing the fundamentals examination, which is an 8-hour examination that if you wish to be licensed in any of the states, you have to pass that examination, and after a minimum 4 years experience, you take another 4-year examination, which is the professional practice exam. And that's another 8-hour examination. In addition to that, we have specialty examinations, which are 8-hour exams. And we have subcommittees under the committee of which I'm chairman that meets in Clemson, South Carolina at the headquarters and prepares these examinations. And this is it's a very responsible position that these people on this committee have, because they have to be sure that the examinations are uniformly fair, for one thing. We have a psychometrician that helps us to evaluate the examination to make sure that this examination that we're giving this year is equal as nearly as possible to the one that was given 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
To be sure that the problems are clearly written, that they're not so time-consuming that they can't be solved by a person with what we call minimum competence.
Mm-hmm.
The competence that we expect an individual to be able to perform at a 4-year level of experience, or for the fundamentals examination when they finish school. So it's a very time consuming thing.
In fact, I'm imagine.
Going up there 4 days next week, and I've already spent about 24 days this year on that committee, and I'll spend another 20 to 30 before the year is out.
Sounds like that's almost a full time.
It takes a lot of time.
In addition to what you're having to actually go there, I'm saying, and research and stuff involved with keeping up with.
Then in addition to that, I'm a national director for the American Society of Civil Engineers, and I was told when I took the job that that was going to be a minimum of 45 days a year for 3 years. So, and that's just meetings, and it doesn't take into account the stuff I was doing this morning before you got here, and getting ready for a meeting that we're having in Maine next month.
Mm-hmm.
So
obviously,
I stay pretty busy.
Retirement for you has not been retirement.
Well, my wife said I'm working harder than I did before I retired. The thing about it though is that I'm doing it at my own pace, at my own. For example, if I don't want to come over here, unless there's something special going on, I don't have to come. My 15%, the department chairman lets me do pretty much like I want, as long as I do those things he asks me to do.
Yeah, sure.
And I spend more than 15% over here. And I probably do more than I'm paid for, but I didn't feel that I should do any more than that when I couldn't commit myself. I didn't feel like I could commit myself to more than 15%.
Yeah.
They asked me to stay on 50%, but I said, no, I've got these other things, I can't do it. So.
Do you do any traveling besides professionally?
I try to work some travel in with the committee meetings. For example, I had a meeting in Annapolis four weeks ago, something like that. And since all my family's in Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, we took 4 or 5 days and we did some visiting on that trip. I had a meeting in Annapolis, and then I had to come back by Clemson to another meeting there. So in between the Annapolis and the Clemson trip, we went all up to Philadelphia, Harrisburg, Lewistown, York, and the town of St. Mary's, where my granddaughter's in school in St. Mary's, Maryland, and Tacoma Park, Maryland.
How many grandchildren do you have?
3. One granddaughter and 2 grandsons.
How old are they?
The granddaughter is 21. She's a senior in St. Mary's, in St. Mary's City, Maryland, which is the first capital of Maryland. 1634. And 2 grandsons. One is 6 and the other one is 2.
Well, there's some age difference in
there. Well, my son was married and he and his wife separated, and he was remarried here about 7 years ago.
Not too late to...
Two children by the second wife.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a change. Had one grandchild about to grow, and then do you get to spend much time with them?
Well, they get down a couple times a year, and we get up there a couple times a year. Yeah.
Do you miss Virginia in that area at all?
Well, not really.
You feel like
I like to go back. I like to go back, but the winters up there, I always felt were miserable. overcast, and when it snowed, it would melt. And of course, when I was a kid, all the heating was done with coal. And I tell the students they talk about the inconveniences and what kind of a house they want to live in. I remember the days when this little mining town we lived in, we had an outhouse. We called it the back house. And in those days, in this little town, nobody had a front lawn. It was a garden. We planted the front yard and the backyard in the garden. We grew our own vegetables. And we had a hog every year. We had the hog killing and apple butter making every fall. Those were great times, as I remember. Of course, I was only a kid then, and I guess I was only 6 or 7 years old before we moved into a house that had an inside toilet or inside running water. The water that we had in our first house was on the back porch. We were really in the backwoods.
Yeah, you said the town no longer exists.
No. This was a mining town. The mining town is still there.
Is it?
In fact, until 2 years ago, the house that I lived in was still there. It burned 2 years ago. We get back up there every once in a while. But I'm a rock hound, and I like to go back up there and collect some of the ore.
Uh-huh.
That came out of the mine. The mine's no longer operating now, but there's still some of the ore on some of the dumps. And I go back up there and pick up some.
A lot of people you could go in the mountains in North Carolina, they have all these ruby mines and that sort of thing. I wonder sometimes how many of those are seeded and how many of them are...
Most of them are seeded now.
That's what I was told. That they stick a good one in there every once in a while to keep business up.
Another thing I like to do, I have to get a good kick out of it too, is in my collection of rocks, they found out about it at the county school system. They call them the technical director or something out there found out about it and asked me one time if I would speak to the one of the fourth grade classes about rocks and minerals. And I also have a collection of fossils. And so several times, and sometimes five or six times a year, I'll talk to fourth grade classes about the geology, and take the rocks out and then look at them and feel them.
Do you have a large collection?
Fairly large, yeah. I probably have 400 or 500 specimens from all over the country. And so that's one nice thing about about working at the university. It has enabled me to use the summers to travel all over the country, and usually at somebody else's expense.
Yeah.
For example, I worked for Boeing one summer, and Boeing paid the expenses out and back. And I worked for Bureau of Naval Research one summer, and the Navy paid for that. And then with the civil defense work, I have been to Montana State, to Penn State, the university, Indianapolis, Leavenworth, courses given all over, and of course they pay your expenses, and it was during the summer when I could take time off, so sure. I've been in every state in the Union as a result of these things that I've been involved with, and this is when I started to collect my rocks, and I have some representative just about every state now.
Mm-hmm.
That's one nice thing about having been here at the university. It's enabled me to do that.
You know what a jackrock is?
A jackrock?
We used to, when I was kids in Carolina, we used to always hunt jackrocks, and they were square, and it looked, I guess that they were that way naturally. They were just like a cube. And we used to, of course, they had a lot of loose, almost like gravel. But after a rain, you could often pick up, it was just made of, I don't know what kind of rock it was, but the rock would be almost perfectly square. I guess the forces are the way that the forces
of nature. Where did you find those?
These were in Carolina. My dad was from Randolph County, North Carolina, which was just about 30 miles south of Greensboro.
Mm-hmm.
He was born on a big dairy up there, and we would, of course, there was lots down here in Florida. We don't have any rocks, and up there that was a big fascination for us. You know, they had quartz and all sorts of things that you could pick up, and that was one of the things.
I'm just wondering what that could be.
I don't know exactly whether it was something that I'm sure that the rock occurred naturally square. Mm-hmm. What made it that way? Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it was
some
properties of the rock caused it to break off in a cube.
We have a rock here in Florida that breaks off that way, but that type of rock, there is some of that. Is it white?
Most of these were brown.
Brown.
It would be a brown, almost. They were hard to see because they were almost the color, that sort of red clay color soil they had up there, and that was a lot of times we would go out after a rain because the rain would either wash the soil away or it would kick up new specimens, and we would, but that was a big thing to find those when we were a kid.
And I imagine what most of the stuff that breaks off in cubic shape are some of the ores, lead and iron and zinc. Fluorite. Those are some that break off in the cubic shape.
It might be some sort of a mineral, I don't know, or an ore. I don't know. What, in addition to your rock collecting and that sort of thing, do you have any other hobbies that you like to?
Camping.
Camping?
Although we haven't done much of that in the last several years.
Do you camp in the should I say, the primitive sense with the...
No, we have, we did for a long while. We did tent camping, but in recent years we've had a van. That, I bought a strip van several years ago and fixed it up for camping. And the last one, the one we have now, I did a part of the work and I had part of the custom made.
But, kind of makes it convenient, doesn't it?
Yeah, the only problem is now the camping, campground's almost as expensive as a motel.
I agree with you. And then, you know, a lot of times people buy these big Winnebagos and things like that, and in addition to the campground cost, you're getting about 8 miles to the gallon.
Unless you've got a big family, I don't know how they can afford those things.
But you enjoy camping.
Oh, yeah.
What do you see for the future? You got any big plans or...
For myself?
Yes, for yourself.
No, I nothing except just keep going as long as I can. I enjoy it. And I, of course, we still want to do a little more traveling. We've been to Europe once, and then we went to the British Isles one time. And my wife and I would like to do some more traveling. Actually, one of the problems with the things I'm involved with is they don't give us much time in between meetings.
Yeah.
This next year, I'm going to have to make some arrangements so that I can get a trip in somewhere.
Yeah.
And for example, there's a trip to Europe that is being conducted by this organization that I'm a national director for. But it conflicts with a meeting that I'm having. For this the trip is on the 7th, from the 6th through the 19th, and of June. And I have a meeting in Clemson from the 6th through the 10th.
Well, I can kind of guess which one's going
to. Well, the one in Clemson is the one that I have to attend.
Oh, you have to attend that one.
Yeah.
I was going to say if there was a choice, I think I wouldn't have any problem making the choice.
I'm not sure just what sort of a trip this is going to be.
Well, it sounds like you've got...
It's going to be Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia. A lot of the countries over there that are having troubles right now.
Eastern Europe.
I don't know whether now is really a good time to go. However, the trip is it's not very well subscribed so far. They're trying to get more. In fact, just got a letter this morning asking people to reconsider. But I can't. I'd already committed myself to this meeting in Clemson.
Well, it sounds like you've got your future pretty booked up. We've covered a good bit of information. Is there anything that you can think of that we perhaps left out that you'd like to add?
I think only that I think the faculty that we have here and have had over the years are comparable to any that I've seen in the country. I've been impressed with them, and I've had an opportunity with these organizations that I've been attending meetings nationally to compare what we have here with people all over the country, and I don't see that anybody any better than we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've come a long ways, and I think we've a great future ahead for the university, for engineering and the university as a whole.
Well, it's good to hear that. You know, I think it's kind of hard to blow your own horn, so to speak, but think that one of the things the university has suffered from is not from a lack of expertise and people on the faculty that are at the top of their field, but just from the simple fact that hasn't really been publicized.
Years ago, when you go to a national meeting somewhere and say, you're from the University of Florida, oh, you're from Miami. And that used to burn me up, you know. Everybody thought Miami was Florida.
Florida.
And now they're beginning to, we began to say, I'm from the University of Florida. Oh, that Gainesville. Yeah, I was, I know some people down there. Do you know such and such a person? And I deal with mechanical, electrical, and civil through this National Council of Examiners. They know the people in mechanical, electrical, and industrial. So I think our reputation is well up there. I've been real pleased with the developments over the last, I'd say the last 15, 20 years. And I don't think we're tops in the country, in my opinion, in research. We have people who are asking for our graduates over others, and they don't mind telling us that they'd rather have our students than students from, and they'll mention the names of other universities. And of course, that makes us feel pretty good too.
Sure.
So I think we have a good future ahead of us.
Well, that sounds good. I'm glad to hear that.
Nice young, real sharp faculty members. It's a shame that. But the financial situation is such as it is. However, we're not alone. As I travel around, I find other states are suffering the same.
I see it on the news every night.
South Carolina, Pennsylvania. My son says that in Pennsylvania they're suffering just like we are here. And, of course, tourism is, it doesn't look like it's down, but according to the people in Tallahassee, it's down. When I travel the interstates, I can't see where it's down.
Right. Yeah, well.
They may not be spending the amount of money they normally do. That's probably
true. That's true. And, you know, I think we forget sometimes how much Florida is growing every day. I know I notice, one of the things I notice, especially since they've passed the new law that requires people who re-register their cars in Florida to switch license plates, and they added an extra charge to it. Have you noticed the number of cars around town with out-of-state plates on them? I have. And I think that's sort of a sign of how much the state is actually growing. But, you know, I agree with you. This situation, this budget situation, is not limited to Florida. Although I think that the tax base, the way it's set up here, has particularly hurt the state.
There's no doubt about that. When my son talks about taxes, he gets very upset. He said, people in Florida don't know what taxes are. He has to pay a surtax on not only the license plate, but they have to pay another tax on their car, and it's about $125 a year additional beyond the tag, and the tag's about $80. And they have taxes on things that we never heard of down here. So we're not, we could stand a lot more taxes in Florida and not hurt us.
At least more on an equitable basis, the way it is now. You've got a few people paying.
Well, I've never understood this $25,000 exemption, homestead exemption. I never understood that.
Another one of those things that was...
I think everybody ought to pay a little something on real estate tax. And there's an awful lot of people that don't pay any because of that exemption.
Well, in the long run, though, what does it hurt? Like you said, the universities and things like that.
That's right.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time
to talk with me today. I like to shoot the bull.
Well, that's, you know, this is part of what this is. It's shooting the bull, but yeah. I think we really got, we did get some good information on here. And